And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, May 4th, 2016. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are Wendy Lawless and Rob Roberge. First up is Wendy Lawless. Wendy is the author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, Channel Bonfire. She has published essays in Redbook, Pals.com, and the Los Angeles Press. A stage and television actress, she appeared on Broadway in the Pulitzer Prize-winning play The Heidi Chronicles and off-Broadway in the Obie-winning play All in the Timing. She lives in California with her screenwriter husband and their two children, and she's here today to talk about her new memoir, Heart of Glass. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Barbara. Good morning.
Good morning. Before I barrage you with questions, I want to read this excerpt from Publishers Weekly, which I thought was a wonderful review. And this little excerpt goes, as she shares her progression from an insecure, troubled girl to a young woman who can stand confidently on her own two feet, the unsinkable Lawless tells a tale of triumph over a difficult past. Readers will be drawn to her unique blend of sweetness, grit, and resilience. I thought that was pretty nice.
Very nice, yes.
Yeah, it's sort of like what every memoirist hopes for, a mention, a very, like, excellent mention in Publishers Weekly.
No, exactly. It was very nice. I was most appreciative.
So this is your second memoir. Will you talk about finding the focus for the book?
Actually, my first memoir, which is Chanel Bonfire, Chanel, like the designer, was the story of my childhood and my sort of early teen years and my tumultuous relationship with my probably bipolar mom, and who dragged my sister and me behind her all over the world, basically looking for happiness and never really found it. But the second book is really what happens to me after I break away from my mother and try to find out who I really am, having been my mother's sort of warden and nursemaid for most of my life, and trying to make my home life look perfect to other people. I moved to New York with the idea of going to film school, which isn't really what I want to do. I wanted to be an actress, but I lacked the confidence to sort of commit to that. So it's really just, it was the continuation of the story, and it was something that my publishers really wanted me to write. So I was very lucky in that I got a book contract to write the sequel, which was actually much more painful to write than the first book because it was it was much more about me and my struggles and all the mistakes that I made as I sort of found out who Wendy Lawless was.
Mm-hmm. Well, Heart of Glass has one of the best first chapters ever. You know, it does exactly what you want a first chapter to do. It introduces the character, it gives us the tone, it gives us the setting. And I'm curious if it was always the first chapter and how much work went into getting it just right.
It's ironic that both my books begin. My first book begins with the fireman breaking down my mother's door in the Dakota after she's taken a bottle of pills. And my second book starts with the NYPD coming in through the door. So I don't know what it is about me and authority, but I seem to have a real affinity for the law, maybe because my last name is Lawless. But, that was very much, it's funny, the first scene always comes to me, and it's like the strongest thing. So the opening scene of Chanel, it was like, bam. And for some reason, that first scene, I had just been living in New York for maybe 3 weeks, only to be later evicted from my apartment, you know, after the weekend, like 3 weeks later, because my roommate had gone out for a pack of cigarettes and didn't come back and was embezzling money from a company owned by the mafia, apparently, even though he seemed to be this very sort of harmless, benign guy. So I don't know. Those were the absolute boffo beginning moments that came to me when I wrote the scene, and that's usually where I start. I start with the first scene written out longhand in a notebook, and I go from there. So that was just very much, it seemed like the absolute right place to start.
Yeah, it was great. The book came in the door and I opened it up and I read that first chapter and I said, okay, I got to talk to this woman.
Aww.
Yeah,
great.
It's great. So you mentioned, you know, starting with a notebook. Did you write the whole book that way? Was the whole first draft sort of in longhand and then you went back to the computer? At what point did you start using the computer?
Well, I write the first scene out, then I type it into the computer, and then I make an outline. My husband's a screenwriter, and I sort of work. He taught me this way. I put big index cards up on the wall in my bedroom because that's where my desk is, and it's kind of unimaginative to say, but it's kind of like a skeleton. You put out a big outline of everything, like the big scenes and things that happen, and then you kind of pad on the muscle and the flesh. And the characters, and as you're looking at the outline, you begin to remember, oh, he was there, or, oh, and then that happened, or so-and-so said this. So that's kind of the way I work with the outline, and then I go into the computer and start working.
Interesting. This would be a great time to hear a little bit from Heart of Glass. Would you read to us?
Oh, sure. Let's see. This is from the first chapter, aptly entitled Put Your Hands Up. I open my eyes at 5 in the morning to see the flashing red lights from a fleet of NYPD cars swirling and bobbling across the ceiling of my tiny 8th Street bedroom. Some 20-year-olds on their own for the first time might have been alarmed, but I thought they gave the Spartan room a kind of festive whorehouse feel. They were a confirmation that I was no longer in Belmont, Massachusetts, under the same roof as my insane, increasingly violent mother, that I'd made my escape. Then a belligerent voice squawked over a megaphone, crackling and beeping below my window. This is the New York City Police Department. We have the building surrounded. Half awake, I wondered who was getting busted when someone's beefy fist started pounding on the front door of our apartment. My sixth sense for disaster, honed over years of sailing the emotional tsunami that was my home life, told me to run for the fire escape. Unfortunately, I was pinned to the bed by the heavy arms and legs of my sleeping boyfriend. Wake up, Michael, I nudged him. Huh? He muttered into the pillow. I think the police are here. What? He bolted up. At the front door, I said resignedly, rolling off the futon and slipping into a cotton nightgown. Here, I tossed him my oriental print robe. My roommate, Beth, a Parsons student fresh from Ohio, met us in the living room. She cowered next to the counter of the kitchenette, clutching the collar of her plaid bathrobe closed over her lance nightgown, like the schoolmarm in a spaghetti western after the bad guys ride into town. Oh, my God, what's happening, Wendy? She whimpered as the reflected red lights played across her frightened face. Open up. This is the police, the gruff voice bellowed from the hall. The police are here, Beth, I said calmly. She reminded me of one of the girls I'd gone to high school with in Boston, cherished princesses who had never had a big zit, or a hair out of place, or a cavity. I felt sorry for her. I'd had plenty of experience with the police, but I could tell this was her first time. It's probably just a mistake, I assured her. I was an expert at pretending nothing was wrong from the years I had gussied up the truth for my younger sister, Robin. Some men came and took Mother away on a bed on wheels, I explained, after Mother had attempted suicide and was taken to Bellevue. Heat wave, I'd pronounced when we found the trousers of one of Mother's bedrooms draped across the wicker chair in Robin's bedroom. They probably have the wrong apartment, Beth, I said soothingly, shrugging my shoulders. I was so good at this. How's that?
That's great.
And everybody goes, oh, my God. You know. So, yeah.
I know. I just loved it. I love that chapter. And I had to keep reading.
No, it's great. And the police end up moving in with us, which proves to be, you know, a really wild weekend, let me tell you. If you've ever spent a weekend with the NYPD, you'll know what I mean. So.
Oh, it sounds like that could be a memoir in and of itself, right?
Just maybe. Gosh, I don't know.
Well, you know, the structure of the memoir was really interesting to me because it seemed that it was structured through acting gigs. And I don't know if that was at all the part of the plan.
I don't know. I think maybe yes, because that, I think, you know, being on stage was a big part of my life. It was my connection to my father, who was an actor. We were separated for a long time. And I think that being on stage sort of made me feel closer to him. and helped me kind of find out who I was. And also in acting, you get to sort of try on all these different personalities and characters and find some part of yourself that lives in them. Mm-hmm. So I think that I didn't even realize that, but I suppose that's very intentional because you play a part and you think, oh, you know, as a sort of method actor per se, you look for the things in your life that exist in the character, and you kind of go from there.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, you know, your mother doesn't look too good throughout this book. And I know you also wrote about her in Channel Bonfire, which now I'm very curious to read. And I think, moreover, I'm curious about your relatives' reactions to your book, and if you let anyone vet it, or if, you know, what your point of view was or your feelings were in writing it and in telling your truth.
I had a friend who had written a few memoirs, and I started writing the first book, Channel Bonfire, as a sort of fictional, as a novel. And he said, don't do that. He said, write the story, use the real names. You can figure it out later. That's what lawyers are for. So I thought, okay. So I started writing the story. And my father by that time had passed away. Not that there was anything bad about him, really, you know, to say. And my stepfather has passed away. And my mother passed away as I just finished Channel Bonfire. So that I often meet people who are writing memoirs and they're worried about what their parents will say or feel. And I, of course, that was all off the table for me because everybody was gone. My sister was pretty upset about the first book and stopped speaking to me for a little while. But then kind of came around, and because two of the big sort of hairy scenes in Chanel basically deal with my sister and very upsetting things. So she was upset. But then she came around and decided that she was happy that I told the story. As for other people, I think I made everybody look pretty good. In the second book, some people I had to change their names. And you know, I like to quote that Anne Lamott quote about, you know, how your stories belong to you and you should tell them, and if people wanted you to write more warmly about them, they should have behaved better.
Right.
That's sort of how I feel about it. But I was truthful. If you know, some people come off as rather unflattering, but that was my truth and my perception of what was going on at that time.
And as you were writing, were you concerned, or did you sort of put those concerns sort of in a file cabinet and lock them up and just say, you know, I have to write this and I'll worry about that later?
Yeah, no, I worried about it later. I really feel, and I've said this before, that the truth really can't hurt you. That lying and being ashamed and hiding things and shoving everything under the rug is really what ends up getting you in the end. You know, you have to kind of go back and clean up that dirty room.
Right.
So it's the darkness and the corners that try to drag you in. So I felt very strongly that this was my story and it was the truth, and that, you know, it can't hurt you because this is what happened. And putting your story out there is very liberating and very freeing at the same time.
Well, you know, really, it seems the rule for narrators and memoirs is to make the narrator the most troubled character in the book. And you've certainly done that here. I mean, I don't think anybody looks worse than you, actually, which is really good, actually.
I'm so glad that no one's ever said that. I'm so glad you said that.
Well, you know, it's a fine balance, isn't it? Because, you know, just as the narrator is having problems, I don't know if others are having worse problems, then the narrator looks a little too good, I think. And in this book, you know, throughout, you know, you're working your way up in theater and in acting, and you know, at first it's not going great, and then it's going better. And you know, we follow your process. And I think just because the character is having some trouble, it makes the reader, I don't know, sympathetic to your plight.
I think that depending on the level of hardship you've endured, you know, that I think that most people can really relate to the story of trying to get your you know, yourself together in your 20s. I mean, it's a very sort of, you know, and I had sort of no map or road, you know, plan for anything. So I was really just flying out there in space looking for something to latch onto. But I think a lot of people can relate to that. I think that those can be very painful, difficult years when you have relationships that end badly, or you get fired from a job, or you're not really doing what you want to be doing. I mean, I think that's something that everybody at that age certainly can really relate to.
Hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am on with Wendy Lawless. Her new memoir is Heart of Glass, and it's published by Gallery Books.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about details and remembering details, because in fiction, of course, we can make everything up. But your details are so specific, and I'm curious if you kept journals or if you returned to New York or, you know, what exactly, how you got so detailed and
right.
So authentic and, you know, I felt like I was there.
Oh, well, I kept a journal. I did keep journals, especially of my years in acting school, which were really crazy. And, very up and down, very roller coaster. And then I also borrowed back letters that I had written. Remember when we used to write letters?
Letters, yeah.
Remember letters? Wow. I know. So I borrowed back a bunch of letters from my best friend, Jenny, and other letters from other people, my sister. And I also looked at pictures and scrapbooks from my acting school friends. I also did research on the internet. I mean, the internet is an amazing resource now. For 80s New York, you know, if I couldn't remember the name of a club or something, I would just go on the internet, or I would call my friend Amy Wachtel, who has kept scrupulous journals of every single rock and roll gig she's gone to since 1976 or uh-huh. something like that. So I'd call her and I'd say, Amy, what was the name of this club? She'd say, it was the Ritz. So those were all wonderful resources. I mean, the internet is really amazing for that. There are whole websites dedicated to. There's one called New York Songlines,
mm-hmm.
where you can basically go down a street and it gives you the history of everything that was ever there. You know, the shoemaker, the bar, the restaurant, everything that's gone too. And also big websites dedicated just to rock and roll clubs in the 80s that are all now gone, as New York has, you know, been completely transformed from what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah.
So dialogue too. Then I imagine a lot of that came from the letters and the journals and everything that was kept, because, you know, it's what people would have said. Or I'm wondering mm-hmm. if at times you wrote dialogue as they would say it had you been right there, had you been taking notes right then.
Most of the dialogue comes from me remembering conversations. I also interviewed a bunch of people, and I was amazed at how much I actually remembered and how little they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, I can actually remember. Don't you remember you were standing next to the Coke machine and you said this to me? And they'd say no. So a lot of those big conversations, I really remember. The breakup scenes, the one-night stands, a lot. And of course, also I'm married to my husband, who appears at the
and
end
he
of the
was
book.
There.
He was a great resource too.
So, I also had
all his love letters to me when back in the day. He had to go dig them up and find them, so I was able to use his love letters as well.
Hmm. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I love the ending. I don't want to talk about it really,
right.
But yeah,
right.
The ending was wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
So when you are working on a memoir, are you reading other memoirs? Are you reading fiction? What are you doing in terms of your reading life?
Well, I'm mostly just reading the newspaper and, the New Yorker. It's very hard. My first book, I read a lot of memoirs because I had never written a book before. And I read, you know, I like to describe my first book as Eloise meets Running with Scissors. I read that book and I thought, wow, that's what I want to do, but I want to write the girl's version of that. I just forgot what I was going to say.
Oh, sorry. About reading, and you read memoirs.
Oh, yeah, so I read a bunch of those books. But then for the second one, I didn't. You know, a lot of those books are really great, but many of them are very, very sad. And I wanted my book to have humor, even if it was dark humor, because I think that's one of the ways that I survived, being able to kind of laugh at it, even if it was just at the end of the whole thing. And so I didn't read anything for the second book. I just forged ahead. I mean, I read novels and things like that, but nothing too heavy while I'm working.
Sure. So are you a barreler through? Did you get through the draft before you started tweaking and revising? Or can you talk a little bit about your process and coming up with a finished manuscript that then went to, I don't know, either your agent or editor?
Yeah, usually what I do is I just try to get it all out into what I call the crappy draft, the sort of not so great draft. But the important thing is just to get it down, mm-hmm. so that you have something to work from. So I wrote everything out. I did maybe three passes on it, and then sent it to my editor, and then we worked on it together from there. You know, those sorts of things. And she, you know, she encouraged me to go deeper at certain moments and be more truthful at other moments and try to bring out things that I maybe didn't want to talk about mm-hmm. that much. Mm-hmm. So it was a much more painful process than my first book, as I said before, because I was pretty depressed and messed up as a young woman. So,
it's a wonderful memoir. And I guess we are coming to the end of our time. Fortunately, we'll have you at the Pen on Fire speaker series in a couple of weeks talking
yes,
more.
Yes, I'm very excited.
Here in Corona Del Mar, not far from UCI, where I'm sitting right now. But in closing, I wonder if you have any advice for the memoirists listening who may be kind of struggling through a draft and trying to get it right.
Well, I think the most important thing is to just write. Don't worry about what other people are going to think. It sounds corny, but you really have to believe in yourself and believe in what you're doing. There will always be people who don't understand what you're doing and don't like what you're doing, but you just have to kind of, you know, everyone is going to have, you're always going to have haters, you know what I mean? So just push that aside and just write. You know, I think there's a writer, I can't remember his name, I think it's Alexander Heyman, who said, you know, it's all shit. Can I say swear words? No.
No swear words.
Okay. It's all, you know, junk until it is, you know. So you just have to keep working.
Yeah.
And believe in yourself. I mean, I know so many writers who are afraid of telling their stories. And, you know, you just have to be very brave and put yourself out there. As an artist, that's what you have to do. And you know, it's not going to be easy.
Mm. Well, thank you so much, Wendy, and I can't wait to talk to you more in a couple of weeks.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, welcome. That was Wendy Lawless. Her new memoir is Heart of Glass. And stay with us, because Rob Roberge will be with us when we get back. So don't go anywhere.
Oh, Lord, why did you send the darkness to me? And the shadows forever to be? Where's the light I'm longing to see? Love once met me by the old willow tree. Now you've gone and left nothing to me, nothing but a sweet memory. Branches green along the stream that runs to the sea. Listen to my plea. Listen, Willow, and weep for me. Gone my lover's dream, lovely summer dream. Gone and left me here to weep my tears into the stream. Sad as I can be, hear me, Willow, and weep for me. Whisper to the wind and say that love has sinned to leave my heart a-breaking and making a moan. Murmur to the night to hide her starry light so none will find me sighing and crying all alone. Weep in a willow tree, weep in sympathy. Bend your branches down along the ground and cover me. When the shadows fall, bend, oh willow, and weep for me. I want you to weep for me, willow tree. Whisper to the wind and say that love has sinned to leave my heart a-breaking and making a moan. Murmur to the night to hide her starry light so none will find me sighing and crying all alone. Oh, weeping willow tree,
and hello again and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And the first half of the hour, I was here with Wendy Lawless. And now I'm back with Rob Robert. She's the author of four books of fiction, most recently The Cost of Living. He's a core faculty member at UCR Palm Desert's MFA program and has taught at several universities, including University of California's MFA programs, mainly at Riverside, Antioch, and LA, and UCLA Extension Writers Program. His work has been featured in Penthouse, The Rumpus, and The Nervous Breakdown, and his stories have been widely anthologized. He also plays guitar and sings with the Los Angeles-based band The Urinals, and he's here today to talk about his memoir, Liar. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Barbara. How you doing?
Great. Great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. I liked this book so much, and I was transfixed most of the way, if not all of the way. I was curious, your previous books were novels and short stories, so I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what compelled you to write a memoir.
It was strange. I think, you know, for writers, some writers know what their next book's going to be in a very concrete sense. But for me, it always has been sort of the project suggests itself if I'm listening. So I didn't set out to write a memoir, really. I did try to do a memoir in 2010, and it was terrible. I got like 40 pages in and was incredibly bored and thought, why would anyone want to read about me? And this is awful. And it made me write a novel, which was, you know, probably a good kick in the seat of the pants to do that. But this one, I just started doing these autobiographical sketches sort of in second person, and I was enjoying writing them. And usually that's a sign for me. If I'm enjoying the process of writing something, it's usually my better stuff, even if it's painful or hard to write, if I'm enjoying the process, you know. And then I published some of them online, and friends said, oh, you have a book here. And I scoffed at them and said, no, who's going to read about me for 240 pages? But, you know, people persisted in that, and I eventually started to listen to them a little bit.
Well, did you find in your fiction you were writing about yourself and what you lived through only fictionalized?
Yeah, increasingly so. My fiction has been pretty autobiographical, and more so with each passing book. And once I did know I had a book with the memoir, I very consciously thought of it as the end of writing about me, like the end of my period of autobiographical writing, whether it be fiction or memoir, I've kind of done me to death at this point career-wise, and it's time to move on to telling stories about people who don't share such an extensive background with me, you know, more made-up people at this point.
Yeah. Well, Liar got such a great review in The New Yorker and briefly noted, and I wanted to read a little excerpt from it and then talk about an aspect of this. And they said, the reviewer said, in a series of non-chronological vignettes, the book moves through enough snappy, barbed anecdotes to save it from navel-gazing and enough harsh soul-searching to rescue it from triviality. And I thought it was great to see your book there. And then the excerpt reminded me of the structure, and Liar employs quite a non-traditional structure where you move among years, primarily the 80s through, I think, 2003, and you do go way back, too, before you were born. 1812 may be the farthest back you go. I'm not sure, but will you talk about that, coming up with the structure for the book?
Well, and you know, the book's about a lot of things that happen sort of in its plot, as it were, but it's also about sort of an exploration of, and to a certain degree, an indictment of memory. And I wanted to structure the book the way my brain works when I'm sort of accessing memories. And that's, you know, in an associative way rather than a chronological way. Like, I don't remember moments in my life with a beginning, middle, end, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
One topic suggests another, one incident suggests another, and I kind of move through time that way. What was the second part of the question? It was really good, and I already forgot it.
Let's see. Moving among the years and, you know, even going way back, like 1812, I thought it was interesting bringing up the Titanic. Just so curious about how these pieces found their place in the book. I mean,
The outside texts, ones that aren't directly about me?
Yeah, yeah.
They were, structurally, I kind of took that from one of my favorite novelists, David Markson, whose later works were just collages of his obsessions. His novels are largely told in little anecdotes that happen in the world that weren't to him. And the plot is sort of gleaned from his obsessions. Like, you kind of find out what the main character is going through based upon what the main character is thinking about. And it could be a really boring way to write a novel, and yet Markson somehow makes it fun and accessible. And I didn't want to go to the extreme that he does, although if you are going to rip off good writers, it's always good if they're obscure ones so your reader isn't aware of it. So they were meant to be sort of illustrative of obsessions of mine that hopefully for me, the intention was that they would sort of bounce off the events of my life in a resonant way, and the two would sort of play off of each other to build something bigger than the sum of their parts. That they weren't, you know, they seem put in there, I've noticed some people, like, as if they were random, and they were one of the hardest things to structure because you could put them in any order, but that doesn't mean it'd be best in any order. So a lot of the hard part of structuring the book was finding the right place for everything.
Yeah, I can imagine you know, in a big room like a gymnasium with all the different sections kind of laid out on the floor going, okay, this 2003 excerpt or this 1983 excerpt goes here and this goes here. Because, I mean, wow, that must have been one of the hardest parts of writing this.
Yeah, that was probably a big part of my last three drafts before it went to my editor, was figuring out where to put everything. Because, you know, I didn't write it in the order. I didn't write it in chronological order, but I didn't write it in the order it appears either.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Rob Roberge. His new memoir is Liar, published by Crown. This would be a great time to hear you read. Would you read a little bit for us?
Well, sure. I'll read just a little from the opening, because then I don't have to give any context for it, I guess.
Okay.
1977. You have your first girlfriend, and you are, as far as your 10-year-old self knows, madly in love. You are Nicole's buddy in science class. That's how you meet, because she's a bright girl who's been advanced a grade, and she needs an older student to help her fit in. And the principal, a man who knows you incredibly well from your frightening number of trips to his office, seems to have decided it might be good for you to be responsible for once, to take care of someone, and not to get in trouble. You and Nicole pass notes in classes like, "Do you like me?" with yes and no boxes. You hold hands in the coat room. Instead of teaching her to behave, you teach her that the more you misbehave, the less adult supervision you tend to have. Screw up, and you are out back clapping erasers together. Screw up even worse, and you get sent to the coat room. Really screw up, and you get to read books together in the library. On your 11th birthday, she is killed in the woods that back three or four of your neighborhood developments, woods that you all played in. You try to remember what she looked like, but you really have no memories of this. You remember two long brown pigtails, but you could be getting those from her picture now on an Unsolved Murders in Connecticut website, in her last school picture ever, taken the year she was killed. She wears a white and red print dress. She has brown eyes that match her hair, which is pulled into two shoulder-length pigtails. She has a posed but happy smile. That photo has replaced your actual memory. You think of her now, and you see the picture that anyone else can see. In the woods, Nicole's head was crushed with a large rock. Bludgeoned is the word the newspapers use. And you have to look up the word, and it will remain your most vivid memory of finding a definition in a dictionary. You are old enough to realize that none of this can be your fault, but you remember the principal telling you that your job is to take care of Nicole, and the phrase will not leave your head, no matter how much you want to take it in.
Thank you so much. That was Rob Roberge reading from Liar. A couple of things that bring to mind. One is, was that always the opening? And if so, why did you choose that to open with? And if not, how did it find its way there?
That pretty much always was the opening. I toyed, after completing a full draft of it, I toyed with moving things around and trying other things. But that went back to, like, every time I would come up with a complete draft, that would be the opening. It has a lot of the sort of DNA of things that follow, losses in our life that we can't control and things like that, stories that don't really resolve, that never allow themselves closure and things like that. So it was an enormously formative event for me, her being killed when I was so young, and that it was unsolved, and that troubled me then, and it still troubles me now. But it seems like a place where, I don't know, I could open the book on a moment of trauma that had suggestion and not closure, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, listening to you read, I was reminded of a thought I had probably as soon as I started reading your book, and that was, this is in the second person. And and as I read, because I'm always so cynical, right, or skeptical or whatever of writing in the second person. And as I started reading, I became so involved in your story. And after I was done with your book, I knew that this would be one of those memoirs I'll always remember, and for many reasons, but one is because you wrote it in the second person, and it worked. It worked so well. And talk about coming up with that, deciding to write not only a non-chronological memoir, but writing it in the second person.
Well, I like what second person does, thank you, by the way, from a craft standpoint of, making the reader sort of complicit in the scenes in a way, if they accept the sort of narrative choice that they're involved in the process in a weird and somewhat awkward at times and very intimate and yet at times disturbing, if it works. But part of it was also just a craft thing. When I had first tried doing a memoir in 2010, I was getting both very bored writing, I did this, I did that, and I was also not able to access the most sort of painful moments and, the ones that exposed me the most, if that makes sense. So, In a weird way, writing it in second person gave me a certain narrative distance to be able to tell the truth and not... I think in a lot of ways a memoir should be all about the moments that you're most embarrassed about, the moments that make you flinch, the moments you wouldn't tell your friends or your lover in some way. And you're granting the reader access to all this stuff that you probably have held in with most of the relationships of your life prior to that. So it's a really uncomfortable process, and doing it in second allowed me to have a certain distance where I could be more honest than I was able to be, saying I did this, I did that. I really like second for its immediacy. I mean, it's very rare that you see second person in past tense. I mean, so it's almost always present tense. There's something sort of fast and immediate about it for me that I really enjoy.
Mm. Yeah,
but, I think you get like one for career. Like, I don't get any more second person books.
Well, it worked so well, and at a certain point, of course, I forgot that it was in second person, and the stories and the anecdotes and the vignettes just sort of carried me through. But man, you're so exposed in this book, and I was curious if you worried at any point along the line about revealing too much, or if you just you're just open and revealing in your personal life, and it didn't faze you.
There was stuff that was hard to write, and then as a sort of secondary tertiary worry is I worried about people in my life reading certain sections, and those are two different things, but they kind of go hand in hand. But I figured once I started that I made a pact with myself that no matter how much it made me squirm or uncomfortable, that was probably a sign that was a scene that needed to be in the book, not a scene that needed to be avoided.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was kind of my litmus test was for the more extreme or traumatic sections was not, it sort of suggested to me that the pieces I wanted in there the least, that I was most personally uncomfortable with, were probably the ones I should write through.
Hmm. This is, I'm not even sure what I'm about to say because I'm thinking it as I'm listening to you, and it has to do with how often writers are told to come up with sort of an elevator pitch for their book. And, unless you have that, maybe you don't have a book. And I was trying to think of how I would come up with an elevator pitch for this book, and because it covers such a huge span of time, and yet everything here pretty much needs to be here, and it works. And
thanks.
I don't know if you thought about that, if you were worried that, it wasn't focused on one little area of your life, or if you, in your mind, as you were writing, had sort of, your one-liner or your paragraph about how to explain what the book was.
No, I'm terrible about that. I rely on my agent to write that in his query letter to the publisher, sometimes friends, I'll huddle them together and crowdsource it out. What do you think this book's about?
Right.
I thought it was in a lot of ways very resistant to a log line. And it was really difficult to think of one, because it's intentionally a sprawling book that doesn't have a traditional beginning, middle, and end, and things like that. And it's, it touches on a lot of things like memory, mental illness, addiction, but it's not singularly about any of those things. I was actually telling this to, we were talking, I was out with a bunch of writers last night, and we were talking about the difficulty that both writers and presses have with, angling the book properly so that it'll get to the right reader, as it were, and, saying in a sentence what the book's about, and that can be reductive or it can help you, depending on how well it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, I have a friend who's been in the music business for 30 years, and he's been on indie labels, but he was on major labels for a while. And he said to me one time, we were talking about a similar thing, and he said, there's a guy at the record company whose job it is to tell people at the radio stations exactly what my music's like in one sentence, and my job is to make his job as hard as possible, which is not a very commercial way to look at it, but I think it's an artistically interesting way to look at it. Not in any sort of like aggressive way, like I'm out to frustrate the guy who does that or gal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But no, I mean, that's something I actually liked, is that it's so sprawling, and but every little piece has to do with every other little piece, and that was satisfying. It's a satisfying read.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And you hope it is when you do it.
We have a few minutes left with Rob Roberge. His memoir is Liar, published by Crown. So we're going to talk more when you're at the speaker series in a couple of weeks. But I just wanted to mention the ending of Liar was so unexpected, because it wasn't a usual upbeat ending, but it was entirely satisfying. and felt right. And I wondered if that was always the ending, or if you sort of knew you were at the end when you were there.
I knew when I wrote that scene that I would probably end the book there. I wasn't positive because I didn't know what I would write after that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, that there was more to write. But once I had written it, that one seemed to me to feel like an ending. And I knew looking at the entire story that it probably wasn't going to be a redemptive tale. So I also thought that it would resist, you know, because one of the issues that I have with, well, really, so many memoirs is that they always end on a note of redemption. And while I think that's great if it's true for the people who wrote it, if their lives just got better and stayed that way, that's a fabulous thing. And I would hope that everyone's memoir would end on a note of redemption if that were the honest representation of the events in their lives. But I knew that mine wasn't going to be that. You know, it was coming from when I was working on it, a very sort of confused and probably, you know, in some ways, it was a very depressing book to work on, you know. Had to dig up a lot of stuff in my life that I don't really want to put under a microscope that much. But yeah, that ending was, once I wrote it, it felt like an ending. You know, just rhythmically too, with the way the last paragraph falls, like rhythm and sentence wise.
Yeah. And in speaking of rhythm, a lot of the book has that. And is it because you are a musician as well, do you think? I mean, would you read this aloud and see, you know, see how the sentences felt or sounded and if the beat was in the right place and all that?
Yeah, I mean, reading aloud is one of the most important editing tools I know of. And, you know, I don't know how much being a musician affects the prose, but I think being a musician affects the prose more than writing prose affects writing music. You know, music is a huge influence in my life, so it falls into my writing, and, you know, rhythm and pace and structure are a huge thing in music. You know, the only thing that writing lacks that music has is melody, which, you know, no matter how beautiful a book is, you can't hum it in a way. So you're dealing with rhythm and pace, really what you're taking from music when I think of that.
Interesting. Well, we're at the end of our time, and I don't know if you have any tips or words of wisdom for the memoirists listening before we get to talk again in a couple of weeks.
I don't know. Just try to be honest and, you know, work with the tough stuff. And, you know, it's a tough endeavor. I salute anyone who goes after it. I'm done with them. I'm going back to fiction.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I can't wait to talk more in a couple of weeks. Thank you, Rob.
Pleasure here. Thank you so much.
Of course. That was Rob Roberge. His memoir is Liar, published by Crown, and he'll be at the Panel Fire Speaker Series in a couple of weeks, so there's more info on that on the website, penonfire.com. Thank you so much for being with me. I'll be back in a few weeks with novelists, and next week, I think, is it Marie or Nicole? I'm not sure, but one or the other will be here with more great interviews, so stay in the chair, get your writing done, and be with you soon.